This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we head over to Hawaii Island, where HPR's Ku'uwe Hiraishi is out in the field reporting on the recovery efforts following last year's lava event. Good morning, Ku'uwe.
Good morning, Catherine. Right now, I'm actually at the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, which folks do know is at the summit of Kilauea. So right now, overlooking Halema'uma'u Crater, it's a lot bigger than it was the same time last year. That crater has collapsed, which was sort of the cause, part of the cause of that magma intrusion in the lower East Rift Zone. So to see the source of the eruption is something new.
So paint the picture. Are the skies blue or is it raining?
The skies are surprisingly blue today. Volcano is usually very cold. You always need your sweater or rainy. But it is nice and sunny. Blue skies with clouds over Mauna Loa. So right now I can see across the crater, which is also rare. I can see Dragon Museum and the former site of the USGS Hawaii Volcano Observatory, which is now currently closed. So last year, the park was closed for about 134 days, so pretty much 4 months. And throughout that time, they've experienced something like 60,000 earthquakes throughout that time. And so when they decided to close the park, there were portions of the park that they decided to keep closed indefinitely, and that does include Dragon Museum, which is right across the way.
I remember when folks were just so downtrodden because the vog was so bad, but no vog today,
right.
Huh?
Right, and that's actually something that we've been seeing, that scientists have been seeing since the end of the eruption. The air quality, both here in Volcano, but also in South Kona, which we know has had sort of the biggest negative impact from this fog, it's actually been clear and good. So people are out there running right along the road here in Volcano. I did get to speak to Rhonda Lowe. She's the acting superintendent here at the park. And she was, I wanted to know how the employees here at the park have sort of dealt with the recovery. And this is what she had to say.
I mean, our employees, you know, they're part of the community. And several of them, you know, their homes were directly affected, and many of them, their families and friends. So it was hard. And I think the uncertainty was the hardest part. People were prepared maybe for a 2-week dislocation of the norm, but the months when it stretched out, that was a challenging time for everybody.
Right. So she did say that they're still actively in recovery. So if anyone does visit the park, there are portions of the park that are still closed off, much of it due to seismic activity that's taken out roads or water main or any other infrastructure that was needed. But I think on the bright side, so Lo is a botanist by trade, and she enjoyed most of all coming back to the park after this four-month closure to see the birds out and sort of bird footprints in the ash or the blooming ohia and things like that. And she called it, I think it was a reset button. So here's Lo again.
It was like a reset button.
Yeah.
Prior to the eruptive events in May, we were actually seeing unprecedented numbers of visitors, very large increases, which was great economically and for the community. And it was great that people had the opportunity to see the park, but we were losing that aha moment that visitors like to come to the park, you know, to be immersed in a natural environment and realize there's something bigger than you. Those aha moments, right? That's what the Park Service is about. And we were getting so popular, you know, especially people coming to see the lava lake, that you couldn't really get those aha moments.
Those aha moments and chasing after them. Right now, I just went by the visitor center, Kilauea Visitor Center, which is sort of the first stop when you get into the park, and it is packed with tourists and residents alike, all trying to catch a glimpse on this sunny day of the crater.
Wow. So some signs of recovery.
Some signs of recovery, and I think the best term that I've heard is active recovery. So folks, we're not quite out of the woods just yet. But for Diane Lee, she is spearheading the county's efforts for the Kilauea recovery. She's the head of the County Research and Development Office. And she says, you know, this is really an opportunity for folks to think of where we're going into the future with a sort of more long-term approach to planning and to recovery efforts. This is what Lei had to say.
I don't think we're going to see a complete back to normal, at least not for a while. People's lives and their businesses have been disrupted. And again, a lot of the focus is on Puna, but there are impacts island-wide. And so I think we're entering an era of a new normal. And that's an opportunity, really, for the community to define what it wants for its future.
So I think Lei characterized it best, and we're seeing some of that in throughout the communities here that are recovering, but hopefully get to talk to more businesses and farmers to see the economic impact, and that's something we're going to be looking at tomorrow.
And you also talked with some scientists, right?
I did. Ingrid Johansson, one of the HVO scientists, the geophysicist, to talk about where activity is. So right now, she says that they are seeing magma continue to refill the volcanic chambers up from the hotspot at the Kilauea Summit, but also along that southeastern flank that runs into Leilani Estate. So magma is still in the ground, but there is no imminent threat, according to their active monitoring right now. But that it is still, we are still on an active volcano, and she wants people to keep that in mind.
Do you know if the county is planning any kind of community meeting just to mark the one-year point?
Right. We have the one-year anniversary. We have been figuring out who's sort of taking different leads on this, and there seems to be a number of different events. The biggest is probably going to be Activate Puna, which is going to be sort of an all-day festival. The USGS scientists are going to be there. Volcano National Parks folks are going to be there. And that's happening May 11th out in Puna. We can have more information on our website, but that may be the next big festival, if you will, to commemorate this event.
Right, because it really is part of the healing process, though, you know, acknowledging and connecting again and just checking to see how your neighbors are doing, right?
Exactly, and that there is that strong sense of camaraderie here with the community, especially in trying to figure out how to move forward. The conversations have been a lot more harmonious than in the past. I think it's sort of wiping the slate clean has allowed them to have a clearer picture of what they want for the future.
Yes, but we do appreciate all the efforts by those first responders, you know, who really tried to keep people out of harm's way as best they could.
Exactly, and then that's an ongoing and continuing effort from folks, because there are some curious onlookers who try to sneak past road closed signs and some of the community areas in Leilani Estates that have been overtaken by lava. They are still seeing folks trying to get in there, so the community is sort of urging folks to stay away while people actively recover, and hopefully they can open up some other spot where you could see some of the volcanic destruction without getting in the way.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Kuvehi. Appreciate your work out
there.
All
right. Thanks, Catherine.
We have been talking with HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi, who spent time with at the Big Islands Volcanoes National Park. You can find her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how oligarchs, kleptocrats, and crooks hide their ill-gotten fortunes in shell companies, tax havens, and real estate. We talk with journalist Oliver Bullough, author of Moneyland, about this secretive transnational world. He runs kleptocracy tours in London of mansions bought by corrupt foreign leaders and oligarchs stashing their wealth. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Pasadena may have the annual New Year's Day Rose Parade in its Queen and Court. In Hawaii, our May Day Queen and her princesses help the state celebrate May Day. If you're not from around here, you may wonder why a mainland American workers' holiday, in part to commemorate the success back in 1867 for an 8-hour workday, can be so different here in Hawaii. Well, here it's a day to make and give lei as an expression of love. It's also time for competition among master lei makers and for the rest of us to enjoy displays of the fresh floral art. In today's backyard quiz, we delve into a bit of lei making, but you won't be using flowers. We're using a berry found on a native citrus tree that grows in wet forests of a certain Hawaiian island. The leathery, maroon-colored fruit is strung into lei for special occasions and once upon a time was used as the base for a popular Hawaiian perfume. The anise-scented fruit must be strung within a few hours of picking, and the resulting lei can be worn by both men and women alike. So what is the Hawaiian name for this versatile berry? And bonus points if you can tell us which island to find it. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Theater in West Hawaii, presenting Harvey, the comedy about a man and his best friend, a 6-foot invisible rabbit, May 3rd through May 19th. Tickets at alohatheater.com.
In a last-minute reversal, the state Senate voted to approve a proposal to tax short-term vacation rentals yesterday. The measure failed to pass a previous vote, but after some political wheeling and dealing, one senator was convinced to change his vote. Gil Riviere was not that senator. He voted against the bill in both votes. His district on Oahu's North Shore has been one of the most impacted by the vacation rental industry. He spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty yesterday to give some insight into how that short-term rental bill was passed.
Yeah, well, actually, it was never voted down. It was a tie on Friday night, 12-12. Therefore, it was neither dead nor passed. It was just there. And so today, Senator Chang moved a motion to reconsider, which would mean let's have another vote on it. And Senator Baker seconded the motion, so that's all it took. The vote to reconsider was carried, and so then it came to the floor for a final vote, another final vote. And at that point, Senator Thielen moved a motion to amend, which would add one small paragraph of enforcement in two places in the law. And we had a rather robust debate on that. And then that amendment failed, and then the main motion was carried 13-12 today. Senator Nishihara switched his vote from a no on Friday to a yes today, and Senator Favela attended today. He was absent yesterday. So what was 12-12, one move to a yes, and then another person showed up. So it was 13-12 in the final score.
And do you have any idea why Senator Nishihara changed his vote?
I don't know. You're going to have to ask him. I'll leave that to I don't want to speculate on his reasonings.
Sure. What are your thoughts on the bill? I know you voted against it.
Yeah, I think it's misplaced. I think it should not have passed at this time because it gives in essence, I believe it gives tacit approval to the illegal activities, the illegal vacation rentals. The city and county is trying hard now to finally pass some legislation, get control of the vacation rentals. And I think we're just interfering with that process by passing this bill at this time. Because it does not have any enforcement. It really, really has very, it has no enforcement. It has a report that these agencies will be required to give to the Department of Taxation. But it is no communication with the counties. There's no coordination with the counties. And I think that's really important to be working compatibly to make sure there's proper oversight of this business.
As I understand it, so this was a tax bill, or it is a tax bill, and the revenue that it would have generated was already being programmed into the budget, the state budget that you and your fellow lawmakers passed before this bill had even passed to go to the governor. Do you have any thoughts on that process, on basically spending money that the state doesn't have yet?
Yeah, I don't think that's good policy. I think until the money's locked in, I don't think they should be spending. But, you know, the commitments are always subject to reconsideration. So the Ways and Means Chair was threatening to eliminate $47 million of bills, and they were bills that were voted on by the 12 opponents of the measure. So he was going to say, if you don't vote for this tax, then all of these bills that you guys want are going to go down the drain. And I don't think that's fair. I think if this money had not been approved, there would be a higher level adjustment and review of the priorities of the Senate. And just to arbitrarily, and I think arbitrarily, pull the bills that were voted on and supported by these members, I think that was, I don't think that was reasonable. He thought it was fair. He thought it was fair. I was like, hey, you know, you don't want the bill. Too bad. Then you don't get the money. But out of a $16 billion budget, you know, $47 million is less than 0.3%. So it's such a small. I mean, it's a large amount of money, but it's small compared to the overall budget. So to have this whole kind of fiasco at the end, I think was just sad for everybody. It was sad for everybody involved. I don't think anybody enjoyed this whole vote.
Well, Senator, your district on the North Shore has been one of the most impacted by short-term rentals and vacation rentals. Do you have any thoughts on that issue at large, or perhaps the legislation that's being considered by the Honolulu City Council?
I went down and testified in support of the City Council measures yesterday. And so I really believe that something has to give this year. There has to be new legislation to get control of the situation. I've had people knock on my door on a Saturday asking me to help them find a place to rent. They grew up in the neighborhood. And they were desperate. They couldn't find a place to live anymore on the North Shore. That's the kind of societal changes we're facing here. And I just think it's tragic that we have all these houses. 20% of the houses in my district are reserved now for tourists instead of residents. And I just think that's a real problem.
Do you have any thoughts on the counter to that argument of people who say that this is their livelihood, that this industry is how they make a living or how they stay in a family home or something along those lines?
You know, most of the vacation rentals are whole home rentals by investors. 85% of them are people who have bought houses and turned them into vacation rentals. So for the people who are living in a home, Tutu, who's trying to survive, pay the bills, and she wants to have somebody come in and share the house, that, you know, the famous home sharing, or renting a room in your house, that I have no objection to that. I don't think anybody objects to that. But Airbnb and these industries are hiding behind that and trying to blow open the doors for all these other people who are snapping up lots of houses. These people are buying something like 20% of the vacation rentals are owned by just a small percentage of people and businesses. There's people that, they're not just buying one house, they're buying two, three, four, five, because each one is a profitable business. And then they're depriving our neighborhoods of being, you know, communities. I just think the free-for-all that's been going on for the last few years must stop. We've got to get control of the situation. And if there's a way that there can be a legalization of a limited number,
And that if that can be controlled, then that's probably the balance. That's probably the compromise place. I don't think there's going to be zero vacation rentals, and I don't think it's going to be unlimited. So where do we find that appropriate balance? And I would say the city council must address it this year. They've got to get on with it and make the tough calls, and let's get control of our neighborhoods.
Do you foresee any additional action, maybe in next year's legislative session, being taken at the state capitol on short-term rentals, or do you think it will be left to the counties to decide?
See, the measure that Senator Thielen submitted was a measure that had this one provision that said, to the maximum extent practical, the director of the Department of Taxation would share relevant information with the counties to help them enforce. See, what's unique is Hawaii is unique because we collect the transient accommodation tax at the state level, and the GET is collected at state level. We don't have local taxes. And so the counties are left managing the land use, but the state collects the taxes. So if the state's collecting the taxes but not sharing the information of who they're collecting it from, then the counties are at a disadvantage for trying to figure out who's actually doing the business. So if there was a way to cooperate between the county and the state, I think that would be the optimal solution. And one thing I've been proposing for 5 years is a statewide registry of vacation rentals. And it's not a tax document, but it's a license like a plumber or an electrician or a beautician, for that matter. Do you know that people that cut hair, they have to be licensed with a state? So we do all of that, but for some reason we don't think that we need to license this giant vacation industry. So if we had a state registry that both the tax authorities and the counties could refer to as, okay, that is a business that's duly recognized as this business, then we've got to start on getting control of the situation.
Okay, Senator Gil Rivera, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
That was a conversation recorded yesterday with Senator Gil Rivera, who represents Oahu's North Shore. Clarence Nishihara, who represents Pearl City and Waipahu in the state Senate, was the deciding vote on the tax bill. We did reach out to his office to find out why he changed his vote, but did not hear back. Honolulu Police Chief Susan Ballard called a news conference yesterday afternoon to answer questions about the status of four officers who were arrested last month for domestic violence. Take a listen.
If an officer is convicted in court of domestic violence, obviously they no longer meet minimum qualifications. They're unable to carry a firearm. So they will more than likely lose their job at that point in time if they are convicted in court for the domestic violence charge.
One of those cases involves Officer Darren Cuchola, and that's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Nick Ruby on the line from Washington, D.C. today. Good morning, Nick, or I guess good afternoon for you.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so your story really dives deep into the Cuchola case.
Yeah, that's right. So Darren Cuchola, of course, is a police officer that I think will be familiar for a lot of listeners, in part because in 2014, he was caught on surveillance video fighting with a girlfriend inside a Waipahu restaurant. Now, that video, of course, went viral in Hawaii and resulted in a lot of demands for more accountability and oversight of the police department in regards to how it handles domestic violence. Now, Cuchola was eventually, a grand jury didn't charge the controller or indict Cuchola on anything, in part because his alleged victim had recanted and said that they were just playing around. But he was fired by HPD and then eventually last year got his job back after appealing the termination through the union grievance process that's afforded to him. And of course, last week he was arrested again on allegations of domestic violence. That arrest came one day after his wife was estranged from him. They're separated. She filed a lawsuit against him for another incident that occurred in 2017. And so Darren Cotrola, in many ways, has just become the face of HPD's problems and struggles to sort of confront domestic violence within the ranks as well as within the community.
Right. And Sergeant Cotrola, like you mentioned, you know, that name was familiar because of that video that kind of really surprised everybody. And then you had this recent lawsuit, too.
Yeah, the lawsuit is an interesting tack that is being taken by Eric Seitz, the Honolulu attorney who's representing Sergeant Cotrola's wife in the case. He basically says that HPD officers helped to cover up an alleged 27 incident in which Cotrola's wife accused him of strangling her, choking her. When he was drunk one night, the officers, according to the lawsuit, showed up and said, you know, this isn't good, and convinced her, again, according to the lawsuit, to say, we just had an argument. He didn't hurt me. I don't want to file charges.
So as far as this case, then, it's just, you know, I know that the chief did say that, well, they've got to, in some ways, their hands are tied because they've got to follow, you know, collective bargaining laws and civil service laws. But it is difficult to investigate.
Yeah, domestic violence is one of those crimes that is difficult to investigate, but there are ways to do it. I mean, if you talk to prosecutors who are successful at prosecuting these cases, they say there are certain things you do on the front end in order to make sure that you can get a conviction on the back end, even if an alleged victim does decide that they don't want to cooperate. Now, Police Commission Chairwoman Loretta Sheehan is one of those individuals. She's a former prosecutor who used to do these cases and was an advocate for many years for victims of domestic violence. Now, that said, I mean, I think one of the things, too, to sort of note about HPD and its handling of domestic violence, particularly within the ranks, is that there are a lot of cases of officers being accused of domestic violence. Chief Ballard said yesterday that there are anywhere between 5 to 7 officers a year who are accused. In the month of April alone, there were 4 officers who were investigated either criminally or administratively for domestic violence. Yet their ability to hold these officers accountable is, quite frankly, suspect. When that video surfaced of Darren Cotrola fighting with his girlfriend, I did an analysis of all officers who were suspended or fired for domestic violence-related incidents, and I found that there were 26 officers who had been either suspended or fired. Only 3 of those officers were actually terminated, but due to the grievance process, they got their jobs back and or were allowed to resign without the penalty or embarrassment of facing discharge. And there are a lot of other cases in which somebody might be suspended for a single day for a pretty serious incident of abuse within a household.
Yeah, but pretty complicated. You have been peeling back the layers. We do appreciate that. And there's also a link to Catherine Kealoha, but I think our listeners will have to go to your website and read that interesting tidbit. Thanks so much, Nick.
Hey, thanks a lot, Catherine. Appreciate it.
That was reporter Nick Ruby with today's reality check. To read his stories on the issue, visit civilbeat.org. May Day is Lei Day in Hawaii, where the day offers the possibility of viewing beautiful lei made by master lei makers on display throughout the state. And if you're lucky, having someone special give you one. In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about a unique lei that is strung up of a maroon-colored berry instead of flowers. Because it can be found on one of the Hawaiian islands, the berry in question is often used to represent its island of origin. Typical of so many native Hawaiian flora, today's answer has multiple uses. It's beautiful and symbolic, but also smells good. The anise-scented twigs and berries of the parent tree were once placed between the folds of tapa cloth for their pleasant fragrance. That tree is the Mokihana, and the answer to today's quiz is the Mokihana berry, which is found only on the Garden Isle of Kauai. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. We close out April with a nod to poet W.S. Merwin yesterday, and today Noe Tanigawa still has poetry on her mind.
Kind of. Well, I got this one particular poet on my mind, Elmer Omar Pizzo, Catherine. I went out to meet him at his home there in Eva Villages. It's kind of family-style neighborhood. It's pretty quiet except for cars passing with their boom boxes going. But Elmer Pizzo grew up in Pangasinan in Ilocos Sur, Philippines. His mother was a military school teacher. His father was dean of an Anglican seminary. And when Elmer Pizzo graduated from high school, he seemed to have his life pretty much cut out for him.
I went to the seminary trying to follow his footsteps, and then I left during my second year.
How did he feel about you leaving?
He was kind of upset and disappointed. He was expecting I would be like him too someday. But
what happened?
I don't know. I think I fell in love with one wahine, so I got out. I regretted that decision because that wahine immigrated to Maui and she married another guy. So that's the start of my failure. I think I've been into a series of failure. So.
Yeah, after seminary, Pizzo went to agricultural school, he farmed, he taught poultry production, and then wages were so low there in the Philippines and options were slim. He joined the legion of other Filipinos who work abroad and send money, remissions, back to their relatives, right, in the Philippines. It's a well-trodden path here. He decided to try working in Saudi Arabia.
Until now, a lot of Filipinos are going to not only Saudi Arabia, we call that the Middle East region, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, Oman, Kuwait. When you go and apply for a job and you're accepted, you're gambling for your life, actually.
Weren't you afraid of them?
No. I didn't have that feeling before. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not bragging about this, but I was never afraid. We were fed in the prison, we were fed once a day only. Rice day, sprinkled with sand. How could you eat? Every Friday I was beaten, whipped actually, and then mutawas, the policemen, with their AK-47s pointed at you. The guy doing the whipping would be telling me, "Anta in charmut, sadik, I'll kill you, you will die. Ana in charmut, if I die, no problem." The more he whipped me harder. But I survived. Every time that whipping rope landed on my back, I told him, give me some more.
You have a poem from that time.
I have. This whipping rope, please. There are two. I hope the Arabs, when they hear this interview and recording, will not be mad against me and portraying them as cruel people, but this is my experience. I lived through this kind of experience, so I hope they understand. My tormentor pulled my head up, looked into my eyes with the sharpness of a Henkel's knife. He taunted, "Oh, my boy, how I love your nerves and flesh. They're so tender and supple. I'm working hard on them to make your suffering more unbearable." As soon as it landed, the rope sneaking up from behind was like the stretched tongue of a Komodo dragon licking my back. Clenching my teeth, all I could see were the eyes of my father as he stared into nothing, and my mother's in her disappointment of me.
Oh, my goodness. That is so emotional. Powerful.
Well, you know what? Pizzo's father had suffered a heart attack. They needed money to keep him going. And he wasn't being paid. He couldn't send any money home. He wasn't paid for almost a year. And he led a strike. You can imagine how that went over. It led to more whippings, eventually led to deportation back to the Philippines. And let me tell you, it was not exactly a triumphant homecoming there. On his way to his home from the airport, the bus he was in a collision, and Pizzo was terribly injured, hospitalized, lost his short-term memory. And his doctor said to start writing. So he turned back to some journals that he'd been keeping in Saudi Arabia and began to write. Even more came out, cruel abuses that he had suffered at the hands of his father. And he had always wondered about that rage until he, years later, heard something from his neighbor.
No, actually, to be honest, my mother is now struggling for her life in Anaheim. She's now 85 years old. I was there in March beside her. And I asked her when she regained consciousness if it was true that I wasn't the son of my father, late father. And she diverted my question. She just told me to forget. So I respected that because she was very ill. So I never postured that question anymore.
Does that help you to understand your father any better?
Yeah, I have a poem here about the poem where I wrote Forgiven. Yeah, that's when he died.
The book is called Leaving Our Shadows Behind Us. This truncated segment here, I'm really sorry about. Pizzo does talk about redemption and forgiveness. His poems are deep and strong and true, and he's going to be reading at the Hawaii Book and Music Festival, noon to one, this Saturday.
All right, powerful, powerful stuff. Thank you so much.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum, presenting the exhibition Rapa Nui, The Untold Stories of Easter Island, on display now and closing Sunday, May 5th. More information at bishopmuseum.org.
In 1989, President George H.W. Bush went on TV holding a dramatic prop.
This is crack cocaine, seized a few days ago by drug enforcement agents in a park just across the street from the White House.
The role of that one baggie of crack in the war on drugs on the next reveal.
This evening at 7, right after Bite Marks Cafe. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. Trey Sombel and Scott Janisch perform Magnuson's new commission, Na Kau Elua, and Mozart's Oboe Quartet, May 6th and 20th. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
Missionary history. Next year marks the bicentennial of their arrivals in the islands. Partners in Change, that's a title of one of two books just published in a nod to that milestone. Ralph Kam, who authored one of the sections of the book, Kokua Aku, Kokua Mai, joined us in the studio this week to give us a sneak preview.
The missionaries arrived shortly after the death of Kamehameha, so in 1820. So 2020 is going to be the bicentennial of their arrival. And because of that, these books were reworked. So Partners in Change is, the fourth in a series. So the first one was published in 1901. It really was a missionary album. They were just trying to preserve the pictures of what the missionaries looked like. And then
beautiful images in this book.
Yes, we were able to get images, you know, the original images. And today's technology is such that the scanning of them is so much better than it was in the past. And so these images are much richer, the detail is better. Between that missionary album and this book, they started adding small, short biographical sketches of the missionaries to add to them. But really, they were just short items, when they were born, when they died, when they got married. And so this book even expands it more. And that's part of the reason I think the title was changed, because no longer was it just the missionary album of pictures. It was really an expanded version of those books, and expanded in the sense that it added Tahitian and Native Hawaiian partners in that process of bringing Christianity to Hawaii.
So it's just a little different dimension than the previous books.
A much more broader dimension.
Wonderful resource for you know, our history really here in Hawaii.
So the other things that are in the book that I think will assist people are images of things that don't exist anymore. So Kauai House started out as a halepili, a large halepili, because it could seat 1,000 people, but nevertheless made in the traditional Hawaiian way. And you get to see that pictures of those sorts of structures, and also the new structures that were built out of coral, like Kauai How, the wood frame house that the missionaries had shipped over here. So all of these structures are illustrated in this book. And besides that, you also get some of the pictures of the boats that they came over on.
Okay.
So these ships, the first ship that came over was roughly, I would say, if you can picture a football field from the 30-yard line to the goal line, that's the size of the ship. And the time that they stayed on the ship to get here, sometimes 5 months. One of the longer voyages, though they had stops on it, was almost 3/4 of a year. So these people that came here were committed, and they knew the sorts of voyages that they would have to take.
So the second book, tell us about that.
Okay, the second book is Kokua Aku Kokua Mai. It's it has five different ways that the missionaries and the ali'i helped transform Hawaii together.
And you helped write a section of that book.
I wrote the section that dealt with the impact of Nahimeni Hawaii. So Nahimeni Hawaii was the first book that was published in Hawaii. It wasn't the Bible, it wasn't a gospel, wasn't one of the letters in the New Testament. It was a hymn book. And I think that they did the hymn book because they saw the impact of music on the Hawaiian people. One of the things that struck me was that the people that were translating the Hawaiian were not native speakers. So Hiram Bingham was one of them, and the other was William Ellis from the London Missionary Society. So those two individuals were the ones translating. But I think that they recognized the difficulty of taking hymns, which are basically poetry, and using a very poetic language, such as Hawaiian, to create Hawaiian hymns. And so what they did was they had individuals that were in the ali'i class who were very well-versed with the Hawaiian language, people like Kalani Moku. And he would read the final drafts of these translations and make comments on them. So it was very much a partnership in crafting these hymns. The hymns were, to say the least, very different from the music that was in Hawaii prior to this use of harmony. So you had the chants, which are beautiful in their own right, but you also have these new hymns. And one of the reasons I think that the hymns were so well accepted was there were Tahitians that came with William Ellis, who had been sent by the London Missionary Society to Tahiti, and they were able to sing hymns that had been produced in Tahiti. And so the king, Liholiho, was astounded by the hymns that were first sung by these Tahitian visitors. And Hawaii also had a very high regard for Tahiti. And because of that, I think there was even more impressive to the king.
So because they were familiar then with Tahitian language, it made it easier to do the Hawaiian interpretation?
Yes. So William Ellis came from Tahiti, and he helped print an edition of the equivalent of Nahimene Hawaii in Tahitian. And he said that he actually learned the language by typesetting that language, because it was a physical thing, but it was also a mental thing. And so that process helped him to learn Tahitian, and then when he came to Hawaii, to learn the Hawaiian language. And so you have an individual who is well-versed in Tahitian, who is applying those same skills to the Hawaiian language.
So do you have a favorite hymn in Hawaiian?
I do, but it's actually not in Nahimene.
But
so
what is it?
The hymn would be the doxology.
Okay. Yes, that's beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, I love How Great Thou Art.
That's, okay.
Yeah, that's my favorite. So the other sections of the book?
Look at various other aspects of the... So when the missionaries came, they had no Hawaiian alphabet. They had to form a Hawaiian alphabet. How do you do that? So... Albert Schutz is a linguist, and you know, he has very deep knowledge into how alphabets are formed. There is just a collaboration that occurred between the missionaries and the Ali'i during the first 20 years. And then the late Malcolm Chun has a chapter here on Hawaiian medicine. And there's that interaction between Western medicine and Hawaiian medicine. And then, of course, under Kamehameha III, Hawaii became a constitutional monarchy. And there was that interplay between the missionaries who were familiar with constitutional models and the Ali'i who were very eager to learn about how they fit within the broader world around them.
So the name of that book again is?
Kokua Aku Kokua Mai.
Kokua Aku Kokua Mai translates to help others be helped. Look for it at the upcoming Book and Music Festival. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we lighten up and take a different turn, celebrating the humor of Rap Reppinger. Got a favorite rap memory to share? Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow for more of The Conversation.